time for This Week in Chicago History with Anna DeVlanta, sponsored by visitUIHealth.care. This is the anniversary of a pretty grim story, a crime story in Chicago, Anna.
Yeah, a very dark day, actually. Bob, you're right. Go back to 1982, the morning of September 28th. Just a dark day in Chicago history that launched a lengthy and intense FBI investigation after a 12-year-old Elk Grove Village girl suddenly dropped to the bathroom floor unresponsive after taking Tylenol. Her parents had given her extra strength Tylenol for a sore throat and body aches, and minutes later she was being rushed to the hospital unresponsive. At first, doctors were like, it was so unclear what's happening that this 12-year-old would suddenly drop dead. And it was only after similar cases started popping up across the Chicago area that they connected the dots to the Tylenol and that it had been contaminated with cyanide. Hard to overstate the reaction that followed. Johnson & Johnson recalled millions of bottles. They swept them from store shelves. There was fear. There was panic. We pulled a clip from a WTTW documentary, Bob, here, the Tylenol murders, including some news segments from that time, local ones that show and national, and how the whole country, the whole nation, was on edge about this.
Yes, it was the top of the news for weeks, and quite a mystery, wasn't it?
It was a mystery that was never truly solved because they had a prime suspect, Bob, named James Lewis, who eventually went away for extortion because he had written letters to Johnson & Johnson headquarters about, I'll stop the murders if you pay me $1 million and do certain things. But they never tied him with forensic evidence to the crimes. And so he nearly took it to the grave. Apparently, he made some sort of deathbed confession to a relative 2 years ago when he died about claiming connection to that crime, but never, ever charged with doing it. The impact, though, created tamper-proof packaging on all kinds of medicines from that moment forward, for sure.
Remaining an unsolved crime, officially. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we should be bringing this up today, the history of the Cubs curse, but go ahead.
Okay, but it was solved. It was solved. Okay, so we reversed it. It's over.
Yes,
but that's 1945,
right.
This week is when it all happened. And just to go back to the way the newspapers reported it back then, it's kind of fun, Bob. In October 6, 1945, Game 4, World Series, Chicago Cubs playing the Detroit Tigers, when the Greek immigrant restaurant owner William Billy Gotsianis walks in. He bought two tickets to the big game, one for himself, one for his goat. And this is the interesting part. Don't forget, Bob, he was allowed in at first. The goat was all decked out in a blanket that read, "We got Detroit's goat." Everybody thought it was cute. He was parading around the field. He was allowed into the stadium. And then people decided he smelled bad he was gone. He was rejected, right? So that's how it happened. The papers covered it, that Gotsianis was interviewed and said, "Them Cubs, they ain't gonna win no more." And he said, "I've got a curse on them. The Billy Goat's curse hangs over Cubs after loss at Wrigley." And it just started to take on a life of its own about the hex, and the newspaper headlines went crazy about this. So there you go. That's how, it all started. We pulled a clip, kind of a fun one, from Stephen Colbert, who lived in Chicago, of course, you recall for like 11 years. And he explained his feelings about the Cubs curse.
Once Cubs won the World Series, we stopped hearing a lot about that, didn't we?
It's over. The curse is officially reversed. We all know that. And goodbye, curse. still not allowed at Wrigley, though.
That's right. Talking about sports, was a big week with the Michael Jordan announcement back in 93.
Yeah, hard to think about, how the city was feeling at that moment in time, because we were all truly shocked. 32 years ago today, the whole city, really the whole sports world, Bob, just shocked and stunned when they learned that Michael Jordan was retiring from basketball for the first time. One of the more memorable lines from the news conference was when Jordan said, "I have reached the pinnacle of my career. I just feel I don't have anything else to prove." And it was hard to argue with that. But you may recall that the mood around that moment was it was like a death had happened. That Jordan was so much tied to the city, that he meant so much to the city, so much to basketball. He was the top of his game, just 30 years old, a global icon, the face of the NBA. And when you look back to that moment in 1993, here's how Jordan delivered the news. We pulled a clip from that news conference when he announced that he was, in fact, retiring from the Bulls and the NBA.
Who knew Jerry Reinsdorf would have a baseball contract for him, though?
Yeah, like who would have predicted, you know, that what would happen next, right? He'd retire two more times, Bob. He'd win another three-peat with the Bulls, play for the Wizards, and have a baseball contract. And boy, I don't know. Lots more happened. But at that moment in time, we believed it was real and that Michael Jordan was gone from basketball. And it hurt. It hurt. It was the end of an era.
Yes, it was. Kind of fun. And the beginning of a new one for the Birmingham Barons. Remember that. Did he trip over the ottoman that time? I'm not sure. But this is an historic week for an Illinois native, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. That theme song, so popular, and that on televisions or that opening is in the early 60s, the Dick Van Dyke Show, Bob. One of the most successful, most loved TV shows of that decade. It debuted this week in 1961, starring Danville, Illinois native Dick Van Dyke, who, along with Mary Tyler Moore, worked their ways into America's hearts with that wholesome, fun, just funny show, right? It was just two of the biggest TV stars of their era. Dick Van Dyke started as a radio DJ in Danville, and he performed in high school plays and moved to Chicago to actually work in theater and do Chicago radio, including appearing on occasion on WGN. In the late 40s, he did local radio. In the early 50s, he appeared on WGN TV with a show he did called The Merry Mutes. And many, many years later, Dick Van Dyke sat down with WGN's Dean Richards and revealed the secret words to the Dick Van Dyke theme show song, or the Dick Van Dyke Show song. They ran an instrumental version mostly on the TV show, but Dick revealed there were actual words to that song, and here he is talking about them in that WGN TV interview.
Yeah, 10 years ago, Dick Van Dyke, and he was only 90 then, wasn't he?
Only 90 when he sang that song so well. He's 99 today, and there's a new documentary coming out about his life, Bob. 100-year celebration that's going to debut in theaters, I believe, his birthday weekend, which is December 13th and 14th. That could be pretty fun to check out.
Remarkable life. Let's talk about good old number 51, born on October 9, 1942.
The legendary Dick Butkus, Bob, that's right. Born October 5th, 1942. They don't make guys like Dick Butkus anymore, I don't think. Just an icon in the football world, Bears Hall of Famer, and just his local ties run really deep. He was born in Chicago's Roseland neighborhood in the shadow of the steel mill on the south side. Solid blue-collar upbringing and just a work ethic and grit and tenacity like no other. Dick Butkus said again and again his Chicago roots were so important to him. He was a star backer at the University of Illinois, Big Ten title. He led the defense to that, and then a Rose Bowl victory, and then drafted by the Bears. So, you know, when he went pro, he got to stay in his hometown, and that was pretty cool to see. He loved football almost as much as he loved Chicago. He said the city was forever tied to who he was and what he became. And here's a little clip from the legendary Dick Butkus.
Yeah, great Southsider through and through. I always enjoyed my encounters with the great Dick Butkus, wonderful personality. Finally, The Chicago hot dog gets its due.
Yeah, this is a fun one, Bob, that you'll appreciate as a hot dog lover yourself. This week in 2009, the Chicago hot dog world got the surprise endorsement and high praise from one of the culinary world's biggest stars. Anthony Bourdain came to Chicago, and he came a doubter. He may be a hater, even, you could say, because he had this strong belief that New York had the best hot dogs and had the best pizza. And he arrived in Chicago this month to shoot an episode of his show spotlighting the city's favorite foods. And he made his way to the gourmet hot dog joint, Hot Dogs. And he was just sold from the start. He called it a temple of encased meats, a place where you can get foie gras and truffle oil hot dogs and still feel like you're at a neighborhood stand. So here he was, Anthony Bourdain, celebrated, respected chef and global foodie, proclaiming Chicago hot dogs were really the best in the world.
We knew all that, didn't we?
Yeah, we knew it. He just had to get convinced. But by the way, he didn't like the deep dish pizza so much, Bob, so just the hot dogs.
And Hot Dogs still lives at Wrigley Field. Anna Devlantis, This Week in Chicago History. Thank you, Anna.